You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden, On the Farm.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden, On the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will celebrate the seasonal bounty of the tree potato, ulu. Experience a local organic planter's relationship with our elder brother, Haloa, and sink our roots into the watery world of aquatic plant production. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How's it today?
Most excellent. So great to be here. Really excited about our show today.
Yeah, we've got a feature-packed one, and sometimes it's hard to jump out of the garden, but when we get to talk plants and geek out on being gardeners and lovers of this beautiful Aina, it's worth the effort. And we're happy to be joining the day with our listeners today, as well as we've got a very special guest coming up in the show. But right now we're going to start, as we always do, with the celestial session, looking to the skies above for inspiration and guidance on some of the activities that might be best suited based on the influences of the planets, the stars above, and everything that's sort of beyond our personal control working with nature. And we'll start, as we do, with the Hawaiian moon phase. And today's moon phase is brought to you by the 2014 Ke Ala o Ka Mahina calendar, a publication of Hui Maoli Ola and Kamehameha Schools, an excellent resource you can find there on the internet. And today's Hawaiian moon is La'au Ku Kahi. Seems like that one comes up often on our garden shows, so I'm thinking that some of you are probably familiar with it. This is in the Poipoi, Anahulu, which is one of 3 weeks in the Hawaiian moon month. And poipoi means rounding or full, so it's part of that week that includes the full moon that we just experienced. La'au Ku Kahi will rise on Kauai at 8:15 p.m. this evening and will set at 9:09 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday. 95% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated. And I've mentioned on the show before how the moon phases move more slowly from moon to moon during the full and the new moon periods of the month, as opposed to the first and last quarters. So I had a look at that, and it turns out that it is amazingly about 10 times as fast.
Wow.
As during the first quarter moon. So back on Monday, we were at 93% of the moon's face was visible, and very slowly, maybe about 3% to down to 1% per day as we approached the full moon was the percent change that we saw, whereas compared in the same month during the first quarter, it was somewhere between 6 and 10% each moon phase. So not really sure how to conceptualize that. One of those reasons I wish I was an astronaut and could see everything from a greater perspective, but very interesting that we get those pauses during the full moon and the new moon phases. We get to enjoy all that beautiful light, or on the new moon side, we get to enjoy the beautiful stars when there's not a bunch of clouds in the sky, raining the heavenly water down upon us, and of course our beautiful Milky Way as well. La'au Ku Kahi is the first of 3 La'au moons. It falls at the end of Poipoi, the second week in the Hawaiian moon calendar. The planting recommendations are mai'a, banana, ulu, breadfruit, and other trees. And La'au denoted good woody growth. It's also a good time for collecting medicinal herbs. And there's your Hawaiian moon phase of the day.
Yeah, I love the image of the full moon growing and waning so slowly. I'm really in the slow down kind of mode lately, and it makes me just want to take a deep breath and really take it all in even more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the biodynamic look at things, our celestial session, today and tomorrow, the moon will be in Pisces, a water sign, making it a good time to work with our leaf plants. And as we're still in the ascending moon period, this gives us an opportunity to do some pruning, perhaps, or cleaning of dead leaves and things like that on our leafy plants. Friday, the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, making it time to work with our fruit plants. We can also look at some pruning there if we need to. I know that I have a lychee tree that's suffering from a little bit of rust. I think I'll hit up the pruning on that particular day. But grafting and air layering can also be good activities on days like this. Saturday and Sunday, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good day to work with our root plants. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Gemini, an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flowering plants. And through experience, I've learned this is my favorite time to do cuttings. I have most success during that moon phase. But also, interestingly, on Tuesday, those of us who follow also the sun will finally move itself into the constellation of Virgo on Tuesday.
Very good. And you mentioned the pruning, and it's reminding me about local weather conditions. And while the celestial influences are important to note, you'll be looking at the weather on that day. On those days, you're looking at pruning. And
if
there's heavy rain, perhaps you might choose another day.
Absolutely. And since the lychee tree is pretty big, I'm not going to put myself on a ladder way up high on a particularly windy day either.
Right on. Very good. Well, we're going to move on to, you said you had a notable news piece for us.
Yeah, a little bit of notable news. I was inspired by our conversation with Richard Ibisu from CTAR a few weeks ago, and the University of Adelaide in Australia has released a full paper called Insect Systematics and Evolution, and one of the doctors there has discovered, actually, 18 new wasp species that target individual varieties of moths. So each wasp has a very particular moth that it likes to eat. And I thought that was very interesting after our conversation also about biocontrols and how safe they are, knowing that there's wasp species that are so specific to their feedstock made me just think that we're really moving ahead in agriculture as far as eco-agriculture goes, and just really steering away from poisons and chemicals to control things for us. And I just thought that was pretty fascinating to discover 18 new wasp species that no one has seen before in this day and age. Just seemed really radical. So
amazing and fascinating and funny that we call them new, as we do, we call them a new species, and yet we look at these interrelationships, and it's kind of humorous because humans are just sort of peeking at nature at a bit more of a depth than they have before, and they're observing relationships that have been evolving over millions of years, but oh, we call it new because we discovered it newly. But really, the delicate balance of the web of life is so exquisite. It's so complex and interconnected, and we just really need to treat it with the utmost care and respect, because without it, we're lost.
It's true. It's true. And that little piece came out of Acres magazine. Again, just such an excellent resource for people into eco-agriculture like ourselves.
Truly. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul. We're here until 1 o'clock. And coming up in this hour, we're going to have a Kahlo Talk story with organic taro farmer Chris Kobayashi. But first, we're going to pick some food straight out of the air. Out of thin air or out of thick air, as the case may be, but we're going to pick some beautiful, ripe ulu.
Indeed. It's high season here at the farmer's market, so those of us who don't have backyard trees can certainly get our fill of ulu at the market right now. It's abundant. It's beautiful. And I do love the tree potato very much. Don't find them so much at the market, but if you find really small ones, about a softball size. You can substitute those in pretty much any recipe that calls for an artichoke heart. And it's really a fabulous way to eat them.
Uh-huh. Do you find that it's okay? I know that the trees will often shed their fruit in the early stages of production. It seems like they bud out more fruits than they can hold, and it's pretty common for them to throw the fruits. Are they suitable when they are thrown, or does it somehow change their quality?
It depends on how long it's been since they've been thrown. Right. If it just dropped in front of your nose, I'd say that's great. Bring it home right away and stick it in the pot to cook it. I've tried ones that I think have been on the ground for a little bit longer, and they don't quite have the same texture. Right. It's really all about the texture of that softball size. And I like to try to get on those before the tree has a chance to shed them and sort of help the tree in my own way to alleviate itself from maybe excess fruit by using them at that stage.
Right, exactly.
But once an ulu is getting a little bigger and still not fully mature, as in soft, that's when we really get into the potato version of things. And if you get one at the market and you can't go home and cook it right away, I highly recommend putting it in the refrigerator, because a couple of days on your countertop, unobserved, could turn it soft pretty darn quick. I've seen this happen. So I really like to cook stuff as soon as I pick it. There's a lot of joy in that for me. But if you can't do that, sticking it in the refrigerator is a good idea. And just a few ideas. Ulu au gratin happens to be one of our favorites in the house. What isn't good with cream and cheese and butter? But also makes excellent potato salad, different versions. And that's when fully cooked in that sort of midway stage. I do want to say that there's some excellent breadfruit recipes out there, and not the least of which is the Breadfruit Cookbook, available online. Faye sells that at ulucookbook.com, and also found some really excellent recipes on Farm Cook Kauai, our friend Janice's website. She has an ulu and yaki recipe that I haven't tried yet, but definitely is high on my list of ones to try next. And just to jump ahead, then you have a ripe breadfruit that you may have found already dropped off the tree and didn't completely splat on the ground. And those ripe breadfruits are excellent roasted over an open fire, really one of the most amazing ways to enjoy them. But they also can be blended into cakes and custards. And for a look at some more recipes, the NTBG, the National Tropical Botanical Garden website, ntb.org, has a Breadfruit Institute, and they do have a thorough list of recipes from some of their prize-winning dishes offered up at their biennial, I guess. Every other year they have a great breadfruit festival over there on the South Shore that's so fun to go to, and I love sampling all the recipes, and they do have all the recipes written out from the prize winners from the past several years.
Yeah.
If you need a little more inspiration.
And yes, I want to encourage people to visit the great website there at breadfruitinstitute.org. Dr. Diane Ragone has been leading that institute for decades now. She's traveled all over the Pacific and collected up the world's largest collection of breadfruit varieties at around 120 varieties from 34 islands in the Pacific, as well as collections, too, from Indonesia, the Philippines, the Seychelles Islands off of the east coast of Africa, and Honduras. And what a wonderful resource their website is. Like you said, amazing recipes with photographs, also a variety database with superb photos by Diane's husband of all the various parts, and just mouthwatering to the idea that we could get our hands on more and more of these varieties. Of course, they've been doing their micropropagation project in collaboration with various institutions, and now with a global horticultural company called Cultivaris. And they have a website, a partner website called globalbreadfruit.com, where they make available, I think they have 5 varieties now that they are micropropagating. You have to buy some pretty large flats of them. You need 72 of them if you're going to order within the U.S., but 288 if you want to order them internationally. So what they're doing is they're making these available, and nonprofit organizations that support development work in third world countries are raising the funds so that they can purchase these flats of tissue cultured plantlets. And the, you know, just one flat of these could produce, if you could imagine how much food it's going to produce over the 50-year lifespan, productive lifespan of these trees, or even longer, is, you know, mind-boggling how much food is going to be produced. And I just want to give a big kudos to Diane Ragone. She's been envisioning this for decades. She had this inspiration. She knew the potential of breadfruit to feed the world, and she's been working tirelessly in this direction. And now her dreams that these would be planted out in third world countries is coming true. It's very exciting. They've made so many varieties available here, or rather to say, so many plants available of the variety Ma'afala. Now Pua'a is becoming available as well, which actually turns out to be a Tahitian variety. I figured it was some Hawaiian version, but it is a Tahitian variety, whereas the Ma'afala is Samoan. And they do have different fruiting times, so trying to get that overlap, not so much overlap, but so that the entire year can be covered in terms of production. We're inching in that direction. And so again, give them a visit if you get a chance, breadfruitinstitute.org. And yum.
I've spent hours pining over the photographs. It's cool when you're a grower and you kind of come to know a plant. And we have generally one variety here, apart from all the great trees that people have gotten through the Breadfruit Institute. But to just look at the different phenotypes, the different characteristics of the fruits themselves and the trees, is just really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So everybody, get on out there to the farmer's market and help yourself to the fruits of the season. We're going to turn right now to the second in our series, a focus on kalo. And we're actually covering the plant family Araceae this month. But of course, the most important member of that family is the taro plant, Colocasia esculenta, known as kalo here in the Hawaiian Islands, and ancestrally known as the elder brother of mankind, Haloa. And right now we are joined by a very special guest in the studio, Chris Kobayashi. Chris's grandparents arrived to Kauai from Japan, and her parents were born here on island in Hanalei in the 1920s. They farmed rice, and in the 1940s, Chris's dad started to grow taro, as well as the truck crops, cabbages, tomatoes, cucumbers, peas, potatoes. He had orchards of avocado, macadamia, and bananas. As well, they raised pigs, cattle for meat, and had fresh milk every day. Chris continues the tradition on the family farm with her partner Dimmy, and they've been providing beautiful organic taro, which is actually kind of a rarity here on Kauai. Such a prized thing to be able to find organically grown taro here, and the fact that you figured it out and are sharing that, the bounty of that experience, is a wonderful thing. It's a real honor to have you in the studio today, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Robin and Paul. Aloha.
Aloha. Well, we have been fortunate enough to have you sharing taro education on the island at various events, at our community seed and plant exchanges for many years now. And it seems like whenever there's an opportunity for you to express your passion, your devotion to Haloa, you're there, and once again, here's an opportunity, and really grateful that you came to share your experience with us. So maybe you could start out by telling us more about the family farm. This is such a tantalizing thing for anybody who grows, this idea that we would be able to take on the traditions of our family and continue them at this time where we need small farmers so much.
You're right. When I started, I had like three jobs, but I was in 1990 was pretty much when I sort of took on responsibility of the farm. And you know, it was a conventionally farmed farm, you know. We did commercial fertilizers, we did pesticides and things like that. So it didn't, and you know, like we have like 10 acres or more, and there's about 27 or 28 lo'i. But at any one time, you would see all the fields planted, except maybe about three of them would not be planted. So it would be constantly in color production, right. You know. And so it was actually in 1997 when Dimi and I had decided to grow Japanese cucumbers. And we just said, oh, let's grow Japanese cucumbers organically. And to us, it was a challenge because, you know, there's a lot of melon flies and, you know, they get stung.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you grow this organically? So we bagged each and every one. We used organic amendments and we did that. And so we had so many that, you know, we weren't able to eat them all or give them away. So we started going to a farmer's market with a small blue cooler. And we had a sign on that said, Japanese cucumbers, $1. And then we'd have little samples for everybody. And people would start eating it. And they were pretty amazed because there's skin on it. You know, the skin is on it, but the skin is so thin. And we also cooled it. So it was pretty crunchy and crispy and nice and cooling.
Yeah.
And people got really hooked on it.
They didn't make it home, basically. People were eating them right there at the market.
Yeah. And, you know, so, and then people started asking us, oh, do you have kale? And I said, kale? What is that? Kale? We were not familiar with that kind of produce. We only knew like kai choy and pak choy, you know, the oriental vegetables that we were familiar with. And so that's how we started growing more than just Japanese cucumbers. We started growing, you know, other vegetables. Mm-hmm. And we started growing it in an empty lo'i, a lo'i that was, you know, fallow for a little bit. And so while we were at the market, we met a guy named Scott Pomeroy. And everybody knows Scott. He had the most beautiful lettuce and beautiful produce. And we befriended him and we said, Scott, can you come and check out our farm? And so Scott came over and, Dimi was kind of proud, you know, this is like way back in the conventional days. So we had a field, a lo'i, that was just newly tilled. It was like all bare dirt and, you know, you feel like it's a nice looking farm. And then go, Scott, what do you think of our soil? What do you think of this? And he picked up a handful of soil and he just said, this soil is dead. Mm. And that was really hard. So Dimi said, what do we do? He said, plant cover crops. And so that's how we started planting cover crops in our field. And, you know, we have pictures that show what the cover crops look like. They were really puny looking. And we didn't even know where to buy seeds from. Mm-hmm. And so we went to Dell's and we bought their bird seed. And it grew. But, you know, that was part of all of our learning process.
Yes.
And that's where we started, just one field at a time without any intention of growing everything organically. It just started with that cucumber
right.
concept.
And that initial inspiration, was it because you felt like there was a place in the market for organic produce or you wanted
no.
to eat organic?
No, yeah, it was no. We had no intention of going to market. We had no intention of transforming the farm. It was just the thing that happened organically all by itself.
Right.
So.
But was that first inspiration that you thought that it would taste better or that the nutrition would be better? What was that first thought of why organic might be preferable?
It was just a challenge.
A challenge.
It was just a challenge, yeah.
Perfect.
You know?
Yeah.
And from there it grew.
So then after trying bird seed as your cover crop, you got tuned into sun hemp, I know, and Sudan grass.
Yeah, we tried buckwheat. We tried sun hemp, cisbania, cowpeas. Buckwheat does not do well in the lo'i because it's too wet.
Mm.
And there's not enough mass. And the lo'i that we have, because we do have machinery, you know, like tractors and stuff, if you have like a really small garden, then maybe buckwheat would work for you, where you have just hand tools. But it was a little too wet because I'm in Hanalei in Waioli. Cisbania does really well, but we wanted to, and we use that if there's no seed for sun hemp, but sun hemp works really well, and we like to use it because it's a nematode deterrent.
Yes.
Because we do, when we rotate our crop and our lo'i, yes, we rotate into the vegetable too, so we don't want the nematodes.
Right.
And the other one is Sudan grass.
Mm-hmm. So you have been growing kalo now multi-generationally. Your parents were growing it. Your dad started growing it. And so you've actually been growing the same ohana of plants for many decades now.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
The relationship of that, yeah, is something I felt from you on many occasions when you've come and, yeah, shared some of your ohana at the seed exchanges. And it's a beautiful thing. So how is it different? What is that quality of difference in comparison with the other crops that you grow?
You mean growing kalo?
Yeah.
It's different. I don't look at, or I don't feel the same way about the lettuce as I do about kalo. I don't know why. I mean, it's just totally different. Mm-hmm.
So you're saving the seed generation after generation, and that's certainly one of the ways in which you achieve a good growing technique. So that's the focus of our segment today.
Yeah.
And if we were to talk about the selection process, you're harvesting the kalo, but you're also saving the seed each generation. Mm-hmm. And there is some method of selection that you're doing. Can you describe that for us?
Well, I mean, it's just a pretty awesome thing just to be planting, replanting, you know, to continually do that. And you think how ancient this plant is, because we've been doing it vegetative propagation. We plant it by huli, by slips. So it's so ancient. That's the most amazing feeling to get that, is that we continue to propagate that. We are responsible for its future, for its now and its future. Mm-hmm. And basically what we do is we just select. You have to observe, select. You kind of throw out the ones that are not doing well. The stronger ones, you want to take the stronger ones. Mm-hmm. And so like one of the things that's happening right now is that we used to plant a lot of lehua variety. And the lehua is just not doing well now. And it's not just us or our farm. We've talked to other farmers and they are having the same thing going on. Mm-hmm. So it just, the only logical thing I can think of is that it needs to rest. You know, put it on the side. Don't throw it completely away, mm-hmm, but keep it on the side. But grow something that's doing well now. It's maybe has to go through some kind of evolution or adaptation or something. I'm sure it'll come back again. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think it's a resting time for it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so thrilled that I got a few hulis from you for my first taro crop, pretty much, of my life, and I was stoked at how well they're doing. I'm not real skilled, but I am certainly giving them lots of love and attention and asking the right questions. So today I'm very excited to hear a little more about good growing, but I want you to know how grateful I am that I have some of your family in my garden.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to share.
So we're starting with healthy huli, and we are now we're looking at bed preparation. And we wanted to focus in. This is such a special opportunity for us here, even in the Hawaiian Islands, that there is a wetland taro production. We're going to talk a little bit more about aquatic plant production a little bit later in the show today. But it is a very special situation that we have here, and a lot of times, for more of our gardeners, we're looking at what is referred to as dryland cultivation, but there are quite a few examples of places where people are growing wetland, and you do that practice. So as we know, there's some differences in terms of how you achieve that, but we want to hear about your experience and, mm-hmm, and what it means to prepare a bed in the wetland style.
Yeah, wetland, lo'i culture, And there's a lot of science that I personally don't understand about all of that, which I wish I could know and learn about. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, what we do is what we have learned from our observation and our experience. You know, in hindsight, I wish I had talked to my dad more and go, Dad, you know, why this, why that? But, you know, I didn't. So, you know, those of you who are here now and want to and have questions and you know someone who has some knowledge, go and ask them because I wish I did. But for preparation, like I said, if you have a good, it's good to start. It starts with the soil. So and what's in your soil. And if I can backtrack just a little about conventional, is that back in the early 90s is when we started noticing the fertility of the soil was going down because of the quality of the taro. It was really different. It was really bad. So we tried different things. Like we thought, okay, if we throw more fertilizer, more conventional fertilizer, it's going to get bigger. Or if we plant closer, it's going to, you know, we're going to have more taro. Yes, you're going to get more taro, but you won't get the quality. So, you know, we were desperate. We didn't know what was wrong. But we find that with cover cropping or with having organic matter in the soil, it has helped. Mm-hmm. So if you have a good cover, you would whatever you plant, you would have to mow it. And then what we do is we spade it. And then we till it in and then let it break down. It might take about a month, you know. It depends on the weather, whatever the conditions are. And then when everything is broken down and it's ready, then you flood the field and you need to till it. We till it one more time, but we pull a board or something in the back of the tractor to make the field as level as possible. And that is for weeding, because otherwise if you have a field that's all, you know, up and down, you're going to have a huge weed problem where it's high, and then and where it's too low, the plant is going to suffer. It's going to be too wet and bogged down. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to level it. Mm-hmm. And then you plant your huli. Different people have different spaces in which they plant. You know, we like to plant 30 inches. We found that's good. Sometimes more, you know. And some people will vary that because certain time of the year you get more babies. So then you plant it farther. Or if you know that it's a certain time of year when there's just mostly the makua, then they'll plant it closer. But we tend to just stay with our measurement, right. You know.
And so what do you use to measure that out each time you're putting a huli in? Just your eye?
Your eye.
Yeah.
But we do string a line right mm-hmm. across. So you have a measurement on the, we have a measurement on the bank that says it's so many feet. And so you know where to put your line, set your line up, but you just plant in the line so you're going straight across.
Yeah. Yeah. If I don't put out a line, it's going to be a crazy snake. Yeah.
And how deep do you plant the huli into the lowy?
Just enough. You'll know. Not too deep, but enough where it'll stand. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so at that time, there is water above the lepo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get your planting in, and what's next?
Well, you have to make sure that the water, you have a certain level inside, you know, a few inches, if you can manage it, a constant, because you want to keep the water in and wait for the canopy for the plant to grow so that it has, you know, enough leaves where it'll keep out the weeds. And it's always in the beginning, it's always about the weeds. Right. Yeah, it's in the beginning. So then pretty much after... I mean, you can actually, sometimes we will, excuse me, I look at me. When we prepare the soil, a lot of times that's when we'll put in our calcium. And I forgot to say, please do soil testing, mm-hmm. you know, and then that way you have an idea of what your pH is and, what your soil is lacking or has too much of. So it's just good to have an idea. And the other thing that we find is, even if you have a space of land, even an acre or 2 acres, you can have a field that's right next to each other, and they will be different, totally different. Mm. You can't treat them the same. Right. Yeah.
So you've amended with calcium, which also changes the pH in many cases, depending on what kind of lime is
depends,
used.
Depends, yeah. So if you've got a high pH, then you don't want to use calcium carbonate. You want to use calcium sulfate.
Right. And then are you putting in some nitrogen source from the outset, or you wait until you get that canopy established?
When we use that, what's that, fish meal from Oahu, we would do it at that same time that we put the calcium as a pre-plant, a pre-application, because it's hard to apply it later.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
Well, that's what's always mystified me, is how do you fertilize in a wetland situation without it just going away in the water? Do you drain dirt periodically when it's time to fertilize again? Do you drain the water from the loci so that you can apply the fertilizer? How does that work?
You know, we used to drain it. We used to drain it down when we did conventional, and we'd walk with our buckets and fill it up, and we'd walk every three rows and throw the fertilizer as we're walking. And I don't know. I mean, I thought about it after. I don't know. And they said dry it till it cracks. Okay, so I don't know if they dried it till it cracks so that the fertilizer can go down to the root zone faster, or if it was just because it was easier to walk on a harder ground. So I never asked my dad that. I still wonder. But so what we do now is, like, when we do organic amendments, we have a fertilizer blower. But you can actually, if you have a small loci, you can just throw it from the bank or whatever you want to do. But we have a small fertilizer blower that can just blow out to the center. He can just walk around the loci, and we leave the water in, and we just let the water go down. So it just kind of dissolves in there.
So the fertilizer's heavier than the water, and it basically settles out, essentially.
But you stop the water flow so that everything goes down.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you can add water again after it dries, sort of dries, and then you add water again, and you can do that a few times.
But each time you let the water level go down, the weeds are ready to come in.
That's why you don't want to do it till you have more canopy.
Right.
You know.
And how much do you monitor the water temperature?
We don't, because you can't. I mean, you know, what can we do? We get what we get. You
right,
know.
Right.
It comes from the mountain where the water is at the head. You know, when it first enters the field. It's pretty cool. I don't know what the temperature is, but by the time you're at the other end, it's pretty warm. And in the summer, it's pretty, pretty warm, and that can cause a lot of diseases too.
Right. We're speaking with Chris Kobayashi. She's an organic taro farmer in Hanalei Basin there in Waiole Valley. And this is In the Garden on the Farm. We're focusing in on kalo this month. The most beloved crop of the Hawaiian Islands, and we're hearing about organic production methods in a wetland setting, and we've established a beautiful crop of kalo. We've got good nutrition in the soil, and we've established a canopy of leaves, and now we're looking at the cropping cycle, and I'm wondering, you mentioned that there is some seasonality differences. Do you plant your fields based on the seasons, or just when they're ready to go? Do you plant all times of the year?
Yeah, you plant all time, anytime, every day if you can, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. But there are times when, like I said, they will have more babies. And, you know, if you have a lot of babies, the makua, the mother, is going to be smaller because babies take a lot of energy out of their mother.
Right.
You have times when you have mostly the makua, and the babies come out late. So the makua will be big, nice, you know, but your babies will be small. You can look at the plant, and they're just like people. Exactly. They're doing the same things that we're doing.
Is it important for you as a commercial farmer to be harvesting all the time also, because of the needs of the poi mill or whatever other kind of production is coming through?
You know, we don't plant for the mills, or we plant by our schedule. If we can, we can. If we cannot, we cannot. If there's a flood, there's a flood. You know what I mean? So,
And you are producing for the farmers market? And as well, I don't know. Do you want to know
silence.
That? Do you want to note that spot there, Jack?
Mm-hmm. I'm not doing a lot for the farmer's market right now.
How do you feel about me asking where, what sort of market are you bringing your tarot to?
Yeah. Can I say?
Please.
Pick it up wherever you guys like.
Well, I know that I've been so happy to receive some of your tarot to eat. It really is my favorite tarot to eat so far, and I love it when you harvest.
So here we are in our growth of this beautiful crop of Kalo tarot, and it takes a while. This is not like a lettuce crop where you're going to be eating in a few weeks. It takes months, and there's phases to it, and it's quite an involved process. Yes,
it's like that saying, it's like a box of chocolates. You don't know what you're going to get till you get in there, like 12 to 16 months later. You know, dry land farming is quicker, I think. The maturity is faster, but in wetland, it can go from 12 to 16 months. And that depends on either the variety of the kalo or also the conditions. Like in the summer, when it's warmer, the plants will mature faster. When it's cooler, the plants will hold longer. You know, temperatures and the water is cooler, it'll hold longer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's approximately 12 to 16 months.
Wow.
And you don't know what you're going to get until you get in there. Like I said, side by side, two fields, they're different.
So when we see changes happen in the patch, like, for instance, myself in the midsummer, I saw my plants, which were very tall, go into flowering mode. And I wondered what that actually meant. Were they coming to a maturity? Was it time to harvest them? I mean, would you talk to us a little bit about the flowering?
That's a good question. I don't know too much about it, except I know it seems like they will flower at a certain time, whether they're ready or not.
Mm.
So I'm not sure how to answer that, because you could have a crop that'll flower, but it won't be ready yet.
That's what I was hoping was the case. There wasn't a whole lot of corm there. I kind of stuck my fingers in there a little bit to see, and they hadn't really sized up yet, but it seemed like either it was the fact that I threw a bunch of seabird guano on them and the phosphorus made them want to shoot up a flower, or potentially the weather finally dried out a bit where I'm growing and they definitely shrank in height during that same period of time. And I hope that I did the right thing. The flowers had pretty much, by the time I saw them, they were already past bloom and kind of gone. And I did decide to cut those off the plant. I hope I made a good choice.
But your tarot's not ready to harvest.
It doesn't seem so,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. Good question for a scientist.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that I've observed that plants in different locations will flower at the same time. So there's larger environmental situations that are causing that signal to happen.
Yeah.
And so beautiful, the kalo flower, so heavenly.
Yeah.
Yes. So it seems, because you don't really know what you're going to get and there's so much variation, you may be looking, oh, this week there's not very much tarot to harvest, and other weeks, whoa, there's a lot. So I'm wondering how you manage the fluctuations of that kind of thing. From either a marketing standpoint or planning your work, that kind of thing. Do you get different output of tarot that can fluctuate wildly based on all of these variables we've discussed, or does it seem kind of consistent?
No, it fluctuates.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what you're harvesting, who your market is. If you're selling to a regular poi miller, one who mills with a machine, you know, the tarot, it's more forgiving. The machine is a little more forgiving versus if they did kuiai, which is pounding stone on board. If they do that, which they make paiai. Mm. Paiai is not poi, it's just paiai is the pounded tarot without water added, and it's a harder, mess. Because there's not the water added, but it'll last longer. So if your market is the paiai people, then you need taro that's way more starchy, very dense. If what happens too, because if you have a big field, you cannot possibly harvest the whole thing. If it's a big field, you can't harvest everything in within a week or 2 weeks. Sometimes it takes longer, a month or whatever. So then the taro will continue to get ripe. It's not going to stop ripening and growing. And so maybe by the time you end up at the end of the field, it might not be the quality that the Paiai people would want, but you can market that to the miller who is using the machine, and it's totally fine. I mean, there's so many things you can make with taro. I mean, it's not just poi and paiai. It's a dessert. It's a main dish. It's sweet to salty. You can make kulolo, just anything. So.
Well, speaking of kulolo, you and your and Demi's kulolo is the most amazing thing I've ever tasted. I can't wait. I'm counting the days until the next time I get to try some. And then, so once we're getting to this harvest period, a beautiful description of different choices we might make based on the ripeness of the product in the field. Once we make that harvest, though, the clock is ticking, and it's actually quite a perishable crop, I've discovered. At least most of the varieties are. And I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners, what are the best ways to extend the shelf life so that we make sure that we're honoring all this amazing work and the resources that went into growing the crop? Do you harvest at a particular time of day? You keep the corms out of sunlight, or do you refrigerate them? That kind of thing.
Yeah, if you're doing like a farmer's market, you want to get that fresh to market. So I would harvest it that day and then go to, clean it up really good, shoot it with water and clean it up really good and take it to the market. But when we're harvesting for off-island and it's going through the barge, it goes in a bag, and we don't have a water hose there to clean it up really good. So there's going to be some mud on it. My dad always used to say, in the old days when they used to ship to the other islands, there was no refrigerated containers at the dock. It was just going on the boat and then reaching Oahu whenever it did. So he literally left. He told us not to clean the skin so well because it helped to keep the moisture in the kalo. But today they might complain because, you know, now there's refrigerated stuff and they go, why are you sending, you know, all this stuff still on the taro? But when you're in the patch and you're pulling bags, we don't have a water hose there to clean it all up. So I would say as soon as you get it, cook it or refrigerate it. I know some people who freeze it. They freeze it.
Freeze it raw or cooked?
Raw. You can do both, but raw. And I found that if you freeze it when it's cooked, the variety I have anyway for sure is that I would need to reheat it in order to get the texture and consistency that I had before. Otherwise, it's like chalky, you know?
Well, we're going to be covering in a little more detail the pest and disease of taro next week with Glenn Tevies, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to mention the apple snail because you're always so fastidious about making sure that people are not spreading this pest that we have so much of here on Kauai.
Yeah, the apple snail is, I think it's pretty much all over the island now. But once you get it, once you know you have it, I mean, they lay these beautiful pink egg masses either on the plant or on some weed, but they come out of the water maybe a foot or two high, and then they'll lay their egg masses. But by the time you see that beautiful pink egg mass, it's too late. You got a problem because there's a couple of mature ones or more that have already mated, and they're in the water. You can't control them in the water. They travel with the water. They'll go. They're slow moving. They like warmer places, but they'll travel upstream too to cooler places because they can adapt. It's really hard to get rid of them in, especially like in wet areas and if you're in lo'i culture. But for us, because of the cover cropping and the rotation and the fallowing that we've done, we've been able to get rid of snails in a field, you know. But they keep reinfesting from above. It's really, really important, you know, everybody wants to grow kalo, which is good. You know, some people want to go to a remote valley and say, oh, I'm going to plant some kalo up there, you know. And it could be a good thing, but it could be a really bad thing because you don't know where this huli was planted. If you don't know where you're getting it from, I mean, you know, and you could be taking snail somewhere where it's pristine and should not have that pest. Yeah. So be really, really careful about that.
Truly.
So to enter into our second last topic of the day, secrets of the soil builders and wetland agriculture and lowy agriculture. Wetlands are such a precious resource on the earth, and not all environments can support wetland growing. We're so lucky here in Hawaii that our sufficient rainfall allows lowy culture, but worldwide wetlands are in danger. And, you know, my recent travels really showed me how incredibly precious water is and how its abundance here on our island makes us so absolutely blessed. And so maybe Paul has a little bit more to say about other wetland agriculture besides taro growing.
Sure. Well, we are in a really special situation here in Hawaii where the wetlands actually have been enhanced and increased through the traditional creation of lo'i systems here in Hawaii, whereas in other places they've been lost a lot through draining wetlands. And so if you look up wetland agriculture, they seem to be in conflict with each other. But here in Hawaii, endangered species of waterfowl are being conserved in lo'i agriculture. And just interesting to know that in addition to taro, certainly the most important wetland crop that's grown here and throughout the Pacific, there are very many other crops that are grown worldwide, rice, of course, being the most important, but plenty of other ones that are being grown here in Hawaii or have potential to be grown, including watercress, ung choy, which is a water sweet potato, wasabi, wild rice. There's been some research into the water chestnut, lotus root. Cranberries are grown in other places, not here in Hawaii. We do have cattail as an invasive species, but is actually a very important food plant of the First Nation people of America. Bulrush, azolla is used as a green manure. Do you use that as a green manure crop in your production
system?
No,
when that happens, it's just floating on the surface, and so what it does is it helps to keep the weeds down, yeah. And it keeps the temperatures cooler.
Nice, nice. And so a lot of people are talking about aquaculture, aquaponics. These systems are sort of in man-made systems, but we have these opportunities to do a variety of other cropping systems. Of course, we need to be thinking about invasive species always. When we're growing in these wetland systems, it's really easy for an invasive species to spread, like that apple snail that Chris told us about, and of course many invasive aquatic plants that we need to be careful about. But exciting, the opportunities for growing more different kinds of crops here in an aquatic setting. We're almost at the end of the hour, so I want to throw out a few quick announcements. We have a Hawaii Farmers Union meeting coming up this evening, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Anahola Clubhouse. It's going to feature our mayor, Bernard Carvalho, as well as Councilman Gary Hooser. We'll be talking about agriculture issues, as well our friend Bill from Princeville Botanical Gardens. We'll hear from Don Heacock, Koa Kahili of Garden Island Chocolate. This is a potluck fest, as it is every month, so more information, kauaifarmersunion.org. We have the 24th Annual Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Conference happening this Friday to Sunday, September 12 to 14, in Wailuku, Maui. And you can get more information at hawaiitropicalfruitgrowers.org. And we have a variety of classes coming up at the Kauai Community College Office of Continuing Education and Training in aquaponics, as well as beekeeping. So go ahead and visit their website for more information, or you can call 245-8318. If you'd like to have your ag-related event or announcement shared on air, please email it a couple of weeks in advance to inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com. If you want to hear previous broadcasts of the show, go to kkcr.org, click the audio archive tab at the top of the page. We'd like to thank the other members of the In the Garden on the Farm team, engineer Jack, phone tech Mac, webmaster Laura Christine, and our station manager Dean. Mahalo, you guys, for making this show possible. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our special guest on air today, Chris Kobayashi. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, too.
Thanks for inspiring us to grow organic, to have a better relationship with this beautiful planet and this beautiful island.
Just a little clarification. We're not certified organic, but we do use the methods.
Organic method. We love it. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that brings us life. Aloha, everybody.
Aloha.
Aloha.